So the next part of the talk, as indicated, focuses more on, rather than the benthos, the actual creatures living on and in close association with the bottom, moving up a little bit in the water column and looking at fish and invertebrates that are present, residing along the shoreline and in the deeper waters out in the middle of the bays. So here again, our study goals were to build on historic data from the area using comparable sampling approaches and gain an understanding of seasonal habitat use by fish and invertebrate assemblages in the study area. I might mention, Ted, this slide on the lower right is actually in that Cottonwood Lagoon that we talked about on the north side of Cottonwood Bay, a large gravel spit that comes around this way but doesn't quite close off. And there's no sill in this one, so there's no perched water at low tide. So our study area, generally in this area, one interesting feature that I didn't mention yesterday is that Inniskan Bay is basically oriented north-south, whereas and the entrance is faces due south, whereas Illiamna and Cottonwood are a little bit more east-west oriented, and so you get an interesting alternation of nasty conditions in there. A lot of times it'll be way too rough to work in Inniskan, and if you run over in here, things aren't so bad, and vice versa. So the previous work in this area on fisheries, Jim Blackburn et al. In the OCSEP work did extensive fish surveys throughout Lower Cook Inlet using beach seine, tow net, gill net, trammel net, tri-net, and doing summit content analysis. So a lot of those techniques we've been working on. Unfortunately, he did not do the small trawl sampling within the Inniskan Illiamna estuary. The other unfortunate thing in the reports, a lot of you are probably familiar with the OCSEP report series, the data are not separated by side of the bay, so Kamishak and Kachemak data are blended in the report. So when we look at comparing the data, it's a little bit tough. And the other major effort in the area was Fish and Game's herring spawn surveys from 1978. We have said to the present, but understand that it hasn't been happening consistently lately. But anyway, a long record of the herring abundance during the spawning time, April, June, using both aerial and ship-based surveys. So our study objectives, to describe nearshore fish assemblages, pelagic fish assemblages, and demersal and invertebrate assemblages, clarify seasonal patterns, examine feeding relationships, and define herring spawning areas, if any. Here's an example. I believe this is an April picture where there's still some ice around. We're doing beach seining, and we are catching juvenile salmon. And then we also got tissues for the sample chemistry. So the field work that we've been doing is using a 120-foot beach seine, a 3-meter otter trawl, 3-meter otter trawl, and gill and trammel nets. In addition, during each of our sampling events, we have been taking those water quality parameters that I mentioned yesterday. And let's see, this is basically the months that we have sampled in the various years of the study. So in 08, we had our most complete survey getting out there every month from March through November. The locations of our sampling, the green dots here are trawl stations, generally out away from shore in the bays. A lot of these end up like MTR3 and MT2B. They're actually on mud flats that are exposed at low tide, and others are in deeper troughs like MPS1T is in the deepest part of Inniskan Bay, and that gets down to like probably 25 meters or something like that. And then the beach seine sites are obviously along the shorelines from Blackie Beach up into the inner Iliamna Bay and Diamond Point. Then we have in the lagoons where we can't really use the big beach seine, we've been using a smaller 30-foot beach seine that was in that photograph a bit ago. And then finally, the gill and trammel nets we used offshore of our other sample sites and in areas where there's more rocky bottom, where you can't really drag a net across the bottom. So we would set those out offshore, usually in essentially tandem, so that we had a gill net and a trammel net at each location, near shore and away from shore. So as far as data, the shoreline area certainly is used by salmonids for migration, feeding, osmoregulation, and refuge. Also a very substantial showing by forage fish, including herring, surf and longsfin smelt, and Pacific sand lance. And then also by flatfish. In the beach seines, primarily, we get starry flounder and our good friends, the staghorn sculpin. So looking at the gross overall seasonal picture here, the pink line is our catch per unit effort in beach seines from March, April through into November. Clearly a very strong midsummer peak, spring and summer peak. This huge peak is driven by age one herring, but generally you have a lot of herring and salmon showing up in this time frame. Then the number of species in the beach seines also shows a strong seasonality, where you have many fewer species in this pretty harsh environment as winter approaches and leaves. For juvenile salmon in Iliamna Bay, the total catch here, chums. We did catch chums in April. Again, we did not catch any in March. Pinks, we caught just a very few in April, peaking in May. Both pinks and chums peaked in May and tailed off later in the summer. And sockeye peaked a bit later in June. And coho and chinook were very, very minimally present in our catches. Inniskan Bay, a little bit different picture with a kind of a curious difference in the pink salmon catches, with them being quite abundant. In fact, the peak abundance was in July, whereas here we had a much earlier peak. And the same with chum, where we had almost like our peak of chum abundance here in April and May, tailing off through the summer. Pink salmon length frequency histogram from April through September. This shows a pretty steady apparent growth in the size of that cohort over time, and pretty good size range. By August and September, they're fairly large looking critters. And a bit curious, if you look at this timing, particularly in Iliamna, where pinks and chums peak in May and drop off fairly slowly, still being fairly abundant in June and in July. And in knick arm work, we saw kind of a different pattern, where the pinks were would peak in April and be very, very few in May and gone by June. So there's a general, and I don't think we're seeing those upper inlet fish down here, but just a curious difference in how long these juveniles will linger in these bays as opposed to in the upper arm, upper inlet. Chum salmon growth, and the chums here are staying around for quite a bit of the summer. Again, showing a pretty reasonable, but a much more varied, much more spread out growth rate. And that may be in just different timing of emergence and out-migration into the salt water. Juvenile sockeye, kind of a different picture. These fish are probably coming from somewhere else. And we have a mix of age classes, including some probable young of the year out migrants and some one plus out migrants. Dolly Varden, quite abundant throughout and fairly constant present throughout from May on. In May, and note that the scale down here is different from the ones we've been showing on the juvenile salmon. So we're looking at a fairly large fish. This is probably the first saltwater excursion for these fish, and they're probably 3 or 4 years old, up in the 150, over 100 millimeter anyway, size range. And then in May, we got more of the larger Dolly Varden, one large one in August, but mainly the shoreline anyway is dominated by this, what appears to be a kind of a one salt cohort coming out. And then we get to the herring. You see we got a whole different scale over here for catch per unit effort. In 08, particularly in June, we had huge catches of herring in Iliamna Bay, averaging over 1,000, close to 2,000 in the bay on that particular sampling event. But herring were present in the intertidal nearshore area pretty much from March through November. And the growth that they show is pretty interesting. We see in March we have mostly older fish, fairly large fish, probably one plus fish. And they, although we didn't catch any in April for some reason, they were present through through the year, including in June of 08, when they were extremely abundant in this size range. Then we start to see the young of the year recruiting, potentially in May, but certainly by July, a very strong cohort of young of the year herring that remain present in the intertidal or the shoreline areas into November. But the interesting thing is in the trawl catches, you see a much stronger abundance in the March, April, and then later in the fall. And it seems like the herring, these guys are moving offshore and into deeper water as the fall wears on. And the catch rates, got another shot here, will show you the kind of a mirror image of each other. Surf smelt, kind of all over the place in the spring, but we think that could be telling a pretty interesting story where these fish may be spawning in the study area. We don't know of any actual documented surf smelt spawning in Cook Inlet, in fact. Certainly it occurs here. We do know a bit about where they spawn in the lower 48, and it seems like the habitat is probably there for that spawning, but we haven't documented it yet. And then we do see recruitment of young of the year coming in. These are really small fish showing up starting in September. presumably from the spawning by these guys that occurred in May and June. Looking now at the trawl results, we have certainly dominated by flatfish, yellowfin sole and sand sole, in particular in Inniskan Bay, and then starry flounder, more dominant in Iliamna Bay, Place and halibut. We actually get a fair number of small halibut in the trawls, so they're definitely using these bays for nursery. A couple of gadids, and then other critters. Snake prickleback is one of the more abundant things, even though it's a very benthic-oriented fish that will actually bury itself, and so probably is underrepresented in our catches. So this is kind of the interesting thing on the herring catch over time. You can see very high catch rates in March and then from September on for herring. And this kind of shows, if you recall the nearshore picture, the herring are peaking in June, July, August. And then there's the balance is that they seem to be moving offshore for the winter months, as is fairly common. Let's see, yellowfin sole peaks in May with recruitment and smaller fish, and I don't think we put up the length frequency for them, but probably a fair amount of growth going on in that time frame. And starry flounder, pretty much there through the year, an equal abundance. And the snake prickleback, the yellow line, numbers seem to peak in May, and then in July we get recruitment of a lot of smaller snake pricklebacks. There's the yellowfin sole. It looks like there's probably a fair amount of migration in and out of the area. This is probably a single cohort here, but we don't see quite the apparent growth that we did in some of the other, like the herring and juvenile salmon. So we're not quite sure why that is. It may be that when they reach a certain size, they move on to some other habitat. Snake pricklebacks, a fairly consistent size that is taken in our catches. And this is probably a new cohort here of the same size. So again, we seem to be possibly gear limited or perhaps geographically limited, where fish that go beyond this particular size class are moving off into other habitats. So this is an attempt to compare our ranking of our species in the beach seine catches versus the ranking from Jim Blackburn's work in the 70s. And again, this is a geographic amalgamation over here. But a lot of the same species show up in the top 10 of both studies. Our number one was herring, and Jim's number one was sandlance, which was ranked only 5 in our study. So that's probably a matter of geography of where his stations were. Sometime it'd be nice to be able to tease out from those 78 data, the specific data for the Inniskan and Iliamna. Let's see. In looking at gill and trammel catches, again, our top 7, most of them tended to show up also in Blackburn's work. Herring was number 1 in gillnet for both of our studies, although we sampled the gillnet in May, July, and September, and I think that Blackburn may have had a wider temporal range of sampling through the summer. But again, we have you know, fairly good representation of the same species. I was a little bit interested to see that you know, the dogfish were an annoyance even back in the 70s. There's nothing like getting a bunch of dogfish wrapped in a trammel net. It's great fun. So, turning now to the benthic inverts, I'll turn it back over to Jason.
Thanks, John. Well, up until now, we've been talking mainly about fish, but we did actually catch other things in the net besides fish. In the beach seine, we really looked at what we caught in the invertebrate community in a more qualitative way, but we could hardly ignore what we were catching in the nets. We caught large clouds of mysid shrimp in the near shore. Oops. Krangon. Gammaridian amphipods, and quote-unquote jellyfish, both polyorcus and comb jellyfish, pleurobranchia. A lot of these were wind-mediated physical forcing, large aggregations in certain areas, but definitely productive nearshore with the presence of mysids and especially krangon. In the subtitle trawls, we felt we could be more quantitative. So we got vastly different things. We got much, much more crustaceans. Krangon, crab, pandalids, shrimp, and hermit crabs. Also, we got some habitat-forming invertebrate sponges, bryozoans, and hydroids. And bryozoans we got in quite large numbers, or bryozoan fragments. In comparison to the fish catch data, we see almost a reverse trend with the invertebrates, where we see large catch per unit efforts late winter and late fall. And this is almost diametrically opposed to fish presence. Could be predation is causing this. It could also be migration. We also do know that many of the shrimp species we captured were going gravid at this time during the year, and we think they actually hold their eggs under the ice in a more detritus-based system, and then when the thaw happens, they send out their zooplankton. They go out as zooplankton. The two dominant shrimp categories were basically krangon species, which we had two, maybe three, and pandalis species, which we had at least three. And what we found is that the krangon tend to like the more fine particle substrates like MTR4, where the pendalids tended to dominate or at least co-dominate in deeper, more sandy habitats. Just to orient you, this is where we caught a majority of our pendalids. Happens to be that deep habitat that we've talked about before, and also here, which is somewhat deep for Eliana Bay, where krangon were here, and here because it was very shallow. And this is just a dominance ranking. Think back to the CPUE when krangon and pendalids are dominant in the catch and there's a lot to be caught. They pretty much go back and forth between one and two early and late in the year. When invertebrate catch is depressed in midsummer, we see the introduction of heptacarpid shrimp as co-dominant, and we definitely found them in more structure-oriented habitats, again in that deep area. This is an example of a pendalid catch. That's a 5-gallon bucket. You two can go to the bays and fill up a 5-gallon bucket in just a couple of minutes of trawling. And I had to sit in the lab and count all those guys. Another interesting catch that we found were tanner crabs, commercially important species. And juveniles tended to be present in most sets that we found in the fall. And these were fairly small carapace width on these guys, maybe an inch and a half. And over 3 years of sampling, we definitely only found them in the fall and to varying degrees. They were always present. So we think this may be a possible overwintering refuge site for barred eye crab. Again, we tried to get into what resources were being used, mainly the invertebrate resources. So a continuation of the IRI, this time a content analysis. We looked at salmonids this time and a couple other fish. What we saw was some very distinct food choice in their guts. What I failed to point out was the number of fish we use in these analyses. So that'll always be the end number. For pink salmon, we saw copepods and terrestrial inverts, mainly flies, in their guts most often. So it shows a definite reliance on what we're not even sampling, the upland. For chum, they had by far the most diverse diet. We actually had to start repeating colors, but they were mostly eating polychaetes, copepods, and sometimes fish. Surf smelt, planktivorous fish, as you might expect. Very high dominance of copepods and sometimes barnacle cyprids and sometimes even barnacles. White spot greenling, which we associated as a structure-oriented fish, it had a very different diet. It was definitely targeting prey species like amphipods, shrimp, and mysids. The shrimp and the amphipods definitely make sense because we found them most often associated with some of these structured habitats like the bryozoans. Pacific herring, another planktivorous fish, by far dominated by copepods. And I guess I ran through that rather quickly, but I'm going to turn it back over to John to talk about the rest of the life cycle of herring.
Okay, well, we talked a little bit about the herring trends over time and the fact that there used to be pretty good herring stocks throughout northern Kamishak Bay and into Inniskin and Iliamna. They had died off substantially, or declined, I should say, beginning in the 90s. So there hasn't actually been a commercial harvest here, I think, since 91 or 92. I forget the exact date, but. And in fish and game surveys, very little, very small, if any, amount of herring seen in the area from 95 to 2004. So we went out in 2006 and did kind of some initial herring spawn surveys in mid and late May and didn't see any spawn. So this is kind of the data from the overall Kamishak Bay herring spawn, miles of herring spawn. And the red bars here are the amount in Inniskin and Iliamna Bay. So it looks like from this it was, I think that's 94, was the last spawn seen in the bay through 2004. And you can see a general decline of the whole Kamishak stock. I believe commercial harvest was shut down in 91. So these are some historic areas of spawn distribution from fish and game data. You can see very heavy use along the east side of Inniskin Bay, some spawn out around these islands here and farther to the north. And then also some from around our MPS-1, past the little area called Entrance Rock here, and then all along this shoreline. All of this is very rocky. And even up into Iliamna Bay and around the corner at the entrance to Cottonwood Bay. This is the look, kind of a different look at the data from the previous two slides ago, showing the proportion of the total southwestern Cook Inlet spawning mile data that occurred in the Inniskin, Iliamna, estuary. So in 2008, we went out in three times in May, June, excuse me, mid-May, early June and mid-June. And the multiple lines are different time periods during which we found spawn in a given area. So in that year, we did find spawn pretty much all around Scott Island, a little bit around some of the islands out here, quite a lot around the mushroom islets. Inside the bay, this is Blackie Beach, and we call this Blackie Point. And also along the area, pretty rocky shoreline here, past MPS 1. We didn't find any farther off to the west or in Iliamna Bay. And just a quick look at the size catch in May of 2008. And so the peak size of the fish that were spawning was in this, looks like 260 millimeter size range. And then in 2010, these lines are the track of areas that we surveyed looking for herring spawn. And this shows where we actually found spawn. These pink lines are areas where there was no spawn seen around Verret, Scott. The reefs in here, the places that we could get to, it's pretty hard. We're doing walking surveys. Basically skiff-supported walking surveys. We actually walked this whole area several miles up into Inniskan Bay. And this whole area is a big, broad mud flat that starts right about here and just gets wider as you go up in the bay. And it's all very patchy eelgrass. A lot of the eelgrass is in small depressions in the mud that retain water at low tide, so the eelgrass can actually continue to grow during low tide. And in this area, the herring were spawning very selectively on the eelgrass. In some of their depressions, there would be large kelp and red algae and a fringe of eelgrass, and they would spawn very selectively on the eelgrass. And in contrast, over in these areas, where it's mostly laminarian kelp and the rockweed or fucus, they seem to spawn very selectively on the rockweed. And that was the initial photograph that we showed here. But in any case, some of the moderate to heavy spawn occurred along this fairly rocky shore here. And in this area, they were spawning on a variety of algae, algal types. I don't have a drawing for 2011 data. Suffice it to say that this line was, again, continuous but intermittent spawning at a fairly patchy level. Again, spawning here and here, a little bit around the mushroom islets. And a fair amount of spawn along this shoreline again. In 2011, in addition to this transect here, we also did a walking survey well up into Cottonwood Bay, where there are also patches, small patches of eelgrass, but we didn't find any spawn. So, for the nearshore fish summary, we do have a diverse suite of habitats ranging from mudflats to fairly steep rock, a moderate stress environment, highly seasonal use, and some interesting contrast with some species having their peak use in the summer and some in the winter months. As a result, we have very variable fish densities. And in terms of probable importance to the adjacent Kamishak ecosystem, certainly the herring spawning, we may have some indication that herring are making a comeback in this area. We've had spawning in the last 3 years that we've looked, and certainly this area is a very valuable nursery for salmon, forage fish, flatfish, and crab. And we'll take any questions.
Ted Otis with Fish and Game. First, just a couple of clarifications, I guess. The reference to the surveys being truncated, those were the vessel surveys. We lost our funding to conduct those, so this past year we didn't do any. We are still doing aerial surveys, although slightly fewer than we were in the past. And the commercial fishery that you mentioned, I think that was 1998, actually, or possibly 99. That was the last year that that fished, not 1991. And let's see. Oh, the other one was the miles of spawn index. That's, well, it's true what you presented there. You know, those are just the aerial survey-based observations of actual active spawn. So by no means do they represent the linear miles of shoreline that could have been spawned upon. You know, your method of going and covering the beaches and foot surveys is going to find a lot more of that, because the spawn doesn't have to be actively occurring to find it. You're just finding the eggs. So it's kind of a minimal reference of where spawning may have occurred. And while we were doing the vessel surveys, I did a lot of those foot surveys of the beach myself, and I would find evidence of spawn in a lot of cases where we hadn't seen it occurring. So I guess I just wanted to mention that. And then I had a question and kind of a comment about some of your fish surveys. I think earlier you'd mentioned that you hadn't seen any rockfish, and I'm just wondering how much of the reason for that might be attributed to your sampling methods. You know, you're using beach seines and trammel nets and I guess some gill nets, and I don't know that you're sampling all of the available habitats, certainly not effectively with those methods. So I guess, do you want to comment first on whether or not you feel like you're actually saturating all available habitats with effective sampling gear?
Yeah, well, probably not. But in terms of a species like rockfish, I mean, I think we're doing a variety of sampling that has probably picked up the great majority of fish that use the area. One species that we know uses the area, a couple of species that we haven't captured much in our sampling are things like skates and big Pacific cod. When we're doing hook and line sampling, we do catch those guys. But the open water pelagic areas, we really haven't sampled. We haven't done tow netting, where we would probably be catching more of the maybe larger salmon, smolts, and some forage fish that may not be well represented in our catch. The rockfish question, that's kind of what we were hoping to see in the gill and trammel net catches, but didn't pick up any there. I mean, that's, we did try to deploy those in those rocky headland areas and reef areas where we can't really do the active netting. So, yeah.
And then one last question, kind of along those same lines. All your sampling effort has been confined pretty much to the nearshore areas, and I'm just wondering whether or not there's been any plans to try to sample the, what will eventually be, if this goes through, the transportation corridor, where very large deep draft vessels are going to be transiting some fairly shallow water to get into the deep water port area. And it doesn't look like you've sampled anywhere along that stretch. And, you know, for instance, I mean, there could potentially be the need for dredging and things like that along that corridor, so it'd be nice to see some sampling effort there.
Yeah, I'm not sure I caught all of that. I'm half deaf. Spent too much time in helicopters. But if you're asking about sampling along the transportation corridor?
Well, not the land-based one. I mean, there's going to be large deep draft vessels that are going to have to come into, you're right, there's deep water there right where the port is, but it's not that deep for quite a long ways going out into Cook Inlet. And there doesn't appear to be any sampling along the corridor that those vessels will be transporting that area. And, for instance, if there's any need to dredge that area to accommodate those deep draft vessels, it'd be awful nice to know what occurs there.
As far as we know, there are no plans to do any dredging in the approach to the port site. So we have not done any sampling beyond, we do have one trawl station that's out in about 40 or 50 feet of water off of Knoll Head. And that's as far out as we've gotten with the fish sampling. So we haven't looked farther outside of the bays, no.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments? Going once, make sure I don't miss anybody. Okay, well, let's give John and Jason a big hand for all that work.